my dad was very hard, and my dad was very, very, like, he didn't show any...
Honest.
He was honest, but to a point where I'd get in the car, if I'd scored a hat-trick, I could have scored 7-8 goals in a game, and I'd be sitting there waiting on the journey home for him to say, well done. And I'd be thinking, like, what, like, any chance you're just saying, like, oh, what a goal that was today or something. And so I'd sit there after 10, 15 minutes and I'd go, done all right today, Dad, didn't I? And he'd go, yeah, you done all right.
Hello and welcome to a brand new podcast. It's called Talent Takes Practice and it's with me, Matthew Side, and my co-host for every single episode will be the one and only Robbie Savage. And this is a slightly different podcast to the one that Robbie and I did before, together with Fred Flintoff, our dear friend. This is going to be about developing talent, about being the best that we can be. Robbie, very interested in youth coaching. He's been doing a lot of that since he retired as a Premier League footballer. I've written a number of non-fiction books about high performance, how young people can really make the grade to be the best that they can be. So we're going to be analysing this, a bit of science, a bit of chat, a bit of conversation. We've also got some terrific interviews, incredible names lined up, mainly through my contact book. Robbie's got one or two. But Robbie, it's great to be back with you, buddy. I think this is going to be a fantastic series.
I think the big question on everyone's lips who are listening to this, Matthew, are there going to be any meaty topics?
Every topic will be meaty. Every single topic will be meaty.
But Matthew, I think the success of our amazing podcast with Freddie, you know, that the insight, the laughter, the fun, this will be slightly different because, as you've said, you've written a number of books, you know, mainly your last two. You know, one was Rebel Ideas, but the recent one, Dare to Be You and How to Be Awesome, focus on teenagers. And, you know, during this pandemic, I was on the government briefing trying to enable kids to come back to sport because the amount of emails and social tweets I had from parents saying, could I help in any way? Because, you know, during lockdown, kids were in their houses, they had no facilities. You know, I've got kids in my team from, you know, all different kinds of backgrounds and some affluent, some, you know, not so. So it was important for me, for their mental and physical well-being, to try and, you know, get on that government briefing to say, listen, when can the kids come back? And thankfully now we've played a few games and the kids are really enjoying being in the fresh air, you know, having fun, building friendships with people. So for me, it's a huge part of my life, you know, and I'm sure throughout these podcasts, Matthew, we'll come on to my sons and your children, sibling rivalry, parenting. And it's something that I'm really, really focused on.
You know, it's interesting when Matt Hancock in the government daily briefing, he said, and next we have Robbie Savage in his face. He couldn't believe it. But actually, for me, that was a brilliant question because a lot of young people wanted to get back to sport. They wanted to have healthy activity. They wanted to be surrounded by their friends again. And I think that was a really good intervention. But we're going to be talking about personal development. We're going to be talking about sport for sure. But we're going to talk about people who want to be good at playing a musical instrument or want to go on to become a great entrepreneur or a scientist or whatever it happens to be. Because for me, Robbie, I think the patterns are the same. And we're not just going to talk to leading sports people and coaches. We're going to talk to great psychologists and business leaders, maybe politicians. You know, we really want to try and get a sense of what we can do as individuals, as parents, as young people to develop the resilience, the adaptability, how to train in the right way so we can all develop.
You know, during lockdown as well, Matthew, you know, the bond with my children, I would say, especially my eldest son, grew in terms of we've done loads of things together and it brought us closer together. You know, he's at Manchester United, a second year scholar. You know, we trained together every day. He asked me questions which I could help him with. And for me, it was a time where I could reflect and, you know, where Charlie would just go to training and we'd come in and say, how do you do today? And, you know, because my relationship with my eldest son, because I was a footballer, it's he sometimes, because I'm his dad and because I've been there and done it, maybe he doesn't ask me those questions. So during lockdown, I think our bond grew. And with my youngest, you know, he plays in my team. You know, getting back for him has been amazing too. So, you know, it'd be good questions on during lockdown, your bond with your children. You know, yeah. I didn't feel at all that bored. I didn't feel at all negative. I embraced it and thought, you know, I've got an opportunity here to spend quality time with my two children.
Do you know, it's funny, when I agree with all of that, but when you did that government press conference, it was right at the height of the pandemic. So this daily briefing was getting millions of people watching, you know, Patrick Vallance and Professor Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, the chief government scientific advisor. And they had political journalists, you know, Robert Peston and Laura Koonsberg. And then I got a call from you that morning. Yeah. I said, Matthew, I'm doing the government briefing today. What? You know, how am I going to get this? How am I going to get this question right? But you actually prepared quite hard for it. You wanted to make sure with that little window that you nailed it.
Well, I got advice off you. What I did, Matthew, is, you know as well as I do, in everything I do, I like to be prepared. I like to have the background knowledge, and I rung you. You helped me massively, which I'm grateful for. I rang a few other friends, you know, who have done exceptionally well in their careers. And I just took a little bit from each of you and added that into my question because, you know, as I think Jurgen Klopp said, he's a wonderful manager, but he has experts around him in their field. And for me, a government briefing is completely different to what I do. And I was so nervous, but it was so important that I had the voice of grassroots. And a lot of people, Matthew, thought I'd done it for my own personal gain, you know, for the academy I'm involved in. But there's nothing far from the truth. You know, I've done it for the well-being and the mental health of, you know, my son, for all the young people, girls, boys, you know, the elderly who do walking football, you know, for all different generations. I wanted to, you know, go out there and really help them. And because I thought we were getting left behind as a grassroots community. And let's be fair, Matthew, table tennis, you'd have started, you know, at a grassroots level indoor in the warehouse in Reading, on that street where you had so many successful table tennis players from. You know, I started in grassroots, so we mustn't forget about grassroots, because most grassroots players, you know, most Premier League players, most people who have a career in any sport have to start somewhere, mainly it's at grassroots. So it was vitally important, and it just made me even more determined to do what's right for all the youngsters around the country.
No, I totally agree. And you mentioned very kindly that I had a book, Dare to Be You, came out yesterday as we record this. And, you know, I just think we need a bit of positivity in this debate. Yeah. You know, it's been, look, don't get me wrong, lockdown has been tough. The pandemic has been difficult for parents and children alike. But my daughter, Evie, 7, about to turn 8, she said to me the other day, "Dad, has my life been ruined?" And I said, "Why?"
Really?
I said, "Why are you saying that?" And then I realised that I'd had the radio on in the mornings while I made breakfast, and she'd been hearing these gloomsters.
Was it Capital FM, Capital or Smooth? No, I bet it was Radio 2 or Radio 4.
It's a Today programme. Oh, well. And people that, you know, had all these pundits saying children's lives have been devastated. They're never going to be able to catch up the lost ground. And kids are going back to school this week. And I just thought, you know, we need a bit more balance. Change is a part of, Robbie, change is a part of life, right? You had to change when you retired from football. You had to develop a whole set of new skills. Kids who are going to leave school and university in this generation won't have a job for life because the world is changing so fast. So they're going to have to get comfortable with change. They're going to have to be adaptable and resilient. And that's why I think these themes, mate, that we're going to address in this podcast, you know, with high performing people, I think it's going to be terrific.
I'm really interested in the sibling rivalry as well, you know, relationship with parents and successful sports people. You know, how do they adapt? How do they encourage their children? You know, so I'm really fascinating to see get into the mindset of these, you know, elite athletes and, you know, not just athletes. You know, you've got a lot of people who I've sat down with, you know. Remember that meal we went to and you brought this professor from this place, another professor from that place, and there was you three talking, and I think I served the bread and the wine, didn't I?
Robbie, I'll never forget. So there was that dinner with Mark Thomas, the evolutionary biologist, and a whole range of other people. The most hilarious one was near King's Cross, where we went for dinner with Professor Neil Lawrence, the DeepMind Professor of Artificial Intelligence at Cambridge University, and his wife, who's the top medical researcher at AstraZeneca. And you said to them, just as you were bonding, so when was the first time you two had sex? They were like, what? Where did that come from? It came out of nowhere, like a thunderbolt.
Yeah, but you know what? All you clever people, like ridiculously clever, you've all been where I am. You know what I mean? You're all normal people. You know what I mean? Normal people. But they're fine. But you're actually so clever.
No, but to be fair, mate, they took it in their stride. And actually, we got talking about relationships and romance and all of that stuff too. So we're really lucky on our first ever podcast to have a couple of fantastic guests. I've got a script here where I have to introduce them. But frankly, I'm throwing that script down because they don't need any introduction. We've got Rio and Anton Ferdinand, two fantastic footballers, played in the same position, grew up in the same family. Might be a bit of sibling rivalry going on. Thanks ever so much for joining us today. I know that Robbie reached out to you, but I'm kind of surprised that you agreed to. Are you mates with Robbie, Anton?
Well, played against each other a few times. He's a bit mouthy on the pitch, but we seem to be all right now.
Matthew, I've got someone in common with these two. A, I'm harder than them. B, I'm fitter than them. B, C was a better player than the pair of them, but they can't accept it.
That's the A, B and B of it. Rio, so it was Robbie irritating to play against? Or what was he like as an opponent?
Yeah, he was irritating. I think he created a persona on the pitch that probably didn't represent him off it. He was annoying. He was somebody that got really on your nerves. He actually got me sent off once. And I ended up beating him up in the tunnel, but it's all right. We're all right now. We're mates now, so it's cool.
Do you know what, Matthew? I was fortunate enough to be at Rio's wedding, and that was the first time I really got to know Anton, and we had a great chat. And obviously, on the pitch, I was an idiot. Just wanted to win. Anton said, "I hated you on the pitch," and same as Rio. But off the pitch, you know, I'm a different animal. On the pitch, I wanted to win, as Anton and Rio did, and I'm sure that. You know, we'll talk about their kids and, you know, their life and how much they wanted to win and what they say to their children. But I think we're all sportsmen, as you as well, Matthew, wanted to win and would do anything to win.
I mean, it's interesting you say that, Robbie, because I mentioned in that intro, Rio and Anton, that, you know, you're not a dissimilar age, came from the same household. You wanted to aspire in the same sport, in the same position. Both immensely talented, clearly very determined. I ought to throw into the mix here that I was a table tennis player, but my biggest rival growing up was my brother, Andrew. 2 years older, a little bit better, and that was a massively important part of my life. And one of the things that made me so ambitious was to beat him. So, Rio, can you sort of take us back to what it was like back then? Neither of you knew at that point that you were going to excel, but was it about being better than Anton, or was it being about being the best you could be?
No, I mean, the age difference between me and Anton's 7 years, so that takes out that competitive edge, because I was far more, in terms of age and maturity and physicality, etc., advanced because of the age difference. But so my role really with Anton was to just always push him. I never trying to get him to make it to football. I just wanted to make him as good as he could be. He wanted to be a footballer. He used to come and watch me play, and he's on the sidelines, and he wanted to be a player. So I would just I'd go in goal, and he'd play 1v1 against our neighbour, and I'd just let his neighbour win all the time, or I'd get really close to the end, and it would be 5-all or 10-all, and it's right, winning goal, we've got to go upstairs, and I'd always probably let the other boy win, unless Anton done something outrageous and just smashed it past me, but I'd be in goal and would never let him score, and he'd just cry and go upstairs. And he'd go, you let him win, etc. But I used to think, I'm getting you tough. You've got to be used to losing. You've got to understand that losing is part of it and deal with it. And you've got to do more to beat him than he's got to beat you. You've got to go that extra mile. And that's the way it was.
Can I just pick up on, Anton, I want to throw it your way in a second. But Rio, that point that you made there, you'd be interested in this, Robbie, about young people needing to have the toughness to deal with defeat. You know, failing occasionally is a part of life. It's how you deal with it that matters most. Do you take that attitude that you had as an older sibling into being a parent? Because I've got to be honest, I've got two young ones and I don't want them to lose. I want to help them. I want to let them beat me at Connect Four. But actually, that's not a smart thing to do. What are you like with your kids?
The same, exactly the same. They hate me when it comes to computer games, to playing cards, to playing board games. I will not let them win. Because I just feel you've got to understand it, and I'll celebrate, and they've got to understand that losing is part of life. But how do you, are you going to come back again, or are you going to give up? That's the key. Like Anton always came back next day or that afternoon. He'd come back and he'd want to play because that was just he had that in him. And it's interesting because I've got two boys that want to be footballers that play. And there's like a 2.5 year difference between them. So the younger one's playing catch-up all the time and they end up almost fighting a lot of the times if it's doing 1v1s and stuff like that, which I like, and I'll let them go to a certain extent. And I have to understand that there's that battle. One of them, the older one's obviously a little bit better runner, but I'm saying to the second one, well, you've got to catch him. You've got to, you might lose, but you get closer next time, get closer until you're near him. And that's always the way that I try and treat him, because I don't do it just to be good footballers. I think it's a life skill.
Right.
Are you going to be someone that comes back from being rejected at some point? Are you? And I look at things like the way they train, the way they apply themselves every day. Are they like, they attention to detail, they make sure they get that last rep done, that last run done, don't cut corners. That will be reflected in their life and the way that they are going forward. So I take a lot from it. And I'll say, like, you cheat or you don't finish your homework with maths or whatever, that will start creeping into your football, into your training. So I try and relate things to things that they like so they improve in all aspects, really.
Anton, you know, Real spoke so well about you there. You know, growing up, when you used to go and watch Real, how inspirational he was he to you? You know, watching him play, watching him at grassroots, you know, following it. Probably, did you have to get up early, you know, with your family and go and watch him go in the cow? There was times when you probably did want to go, you know, but how much of an inspiration was he to you?
He was massive, a massive inspiration to me. I mean, it was always an education. I looked at his education when I went and watched him play because he was that good from a young age. He was that good, in my eyes, he was anyway. When he used to play for Eltham Town, even going to watch him play for them, and it was just education to see like his work ethic was different to other people, you know, and that never say die attitude. He's always had that. It's never a case of when he started to play for West Ham, he got it. He's always had that, and I watched that from a very, very young age. And
but you know that, Anton. Just, you know now, you know when you were growing up though. Do you know like I've got two boys now, you know, 3 years between them. Would there be times when, you know, your mother or you know, your dad would say, do you know what? You've got to come. But you wanted to maybe do something else. You weren't never forced to go and watch him. It was always you wanted to go and watch him and encourage him.
Yeah, at a young age, younger age, I didn't need to be forced to go and watch him. I always wanted to go and watch. As I got a bit older and I started to like different things and started to get in different things, then it was more of a case of, Anton, you're coming to watch, you know. But as I say, I saw it as it being educational and seeing someone that you look up to as your brother, someone who's your hero, to watch the steps and be with them every step of the way in terms of watching them, not being on the pitch, but watching them day to day, watching them every Saturday. And I still remember Rio being, I think he was an under 16 and he played in the FA Youth Cup. I think it was semi-finals against Chelsea.
No, the Southern Junior Floodlit Cup.
The Floodlit Cup it was, yeah, that's it. And you playing in a number 10 role, and you was younger than all of the other boys. But your appetite for the game and the way that you took, remember you didn't play the first game and they lost the first game, and you played the second game in a number 10, and the way you took the game by the scruff of the neck and made it your game, you know, that was a big, big moment for me to say that this is what I want to do. I want to be that type of person. I want to come into West Ham, and people were saying, you see that kid, Anton Ferdinand, he's going to be a player. And that was a pivotal moment for me in my upbringing and watching Rio.
So interesting, Anton. You describe Rio, your brother, as a role model, somebody you looked up to, somebody who was a bit of a hero. And I can see how you wanted to emulate and copy his attitude, the fact that he was taking ownership over his training and his own personal responsibility to be the best he could be. But Rio, I mean, you were clearly tough in the right way, in the way you mentored Anton. But where did that come from in you? How did you internalise that?
It's my dad. My dad used to do the same thing to me. So Anton would have been too young, but my dad would come. My dad was like a kung fu. You should do kung fu and stuff like that, combat stuff.
To be fair, your dad didn't teach you kung fu very well because I absolutely smashed you in the summer.
So my dad was always doing combative stuff, and he wasn't into football at all, but he was into physical working. Like, he used to like working out. So he'd get on a bike, and he'd know I've got training or something, and he'd go, you've got to keep fit to play football. So he'd get on a bike, and he'd just say, follow me. Wherever I go, you've got to follow me on the bike. And I'd be running, and I'd be almost crying, thinking, this is killing me. What is he doing? And then we'd get to somewhere, and he'd like, go and do, like, doggies, run back and forth, etc., some different physical stuff, like ab stuff, press-ups and stuff. And he'd go, right, run with me now behind the bike, back to the estate.
From what age was that happening, Rio?
Wow.
That was like 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, all of them ages. Like, it was just like relentless. Probably enough, I'm 11, 11, 12, 13. So he was just like relentless. And my dad was very stern, as Anton will tell you. He was very like, there was no, dad, I can't. He was like, what do you mean you can't? Follow me. And then and that was it.
And at that point in your life, Rio, was football something that you were passionate about already? In other words, was he kind of pushing you to do something that you already loved? Or was he pushing you to do something that actually I wasn't that keen on, but I got keen on it later?
No, I already had the passion. Our parents weren't like pushy parents. It was more like they were reactive to what we were interested in. So whether it was like drama, athletics, I'd done ballet at a young age, football, it all fell into, if you're interested, we'll facilitate you getting there. And my dad was like, I'm going to train you.
So, Anton, you mentioned there about, you know, the pathways, you know, and I'm sure as I've spoke to Rio and yourself on many occasions, there will have been, you know, youngsters in your community who might have had the talent, but the pathways they probably chose were wrong. How did you pick the correct pathways? Was it from your parents?
Yeah, it was definitely from our mum and dad. We grew up on an estate which was it was multicultural first and foremost, but there was a lot of stuff happening on it. You know, a lot of my friends, as Rio would know, I wasn't the best on my estate in my age group, but I had the backing of my parents. Some of them didn't, and some of them took the wrong path, you know. But I think what kept me on the straight and narrow was I feared disappointing my mum and dad and my brother more than accepting to hold, whether it be drugs or a knife, from someone on the estate. I would happily say no to them just so I wouldn't disappoint and upset my mum, dad and my brother. I feared that more than actually holding anything for someone that I shouldn't be.
On the estate, Anton, take us there. Tell us what it was like, about the flat that you lived in or the house that you lived in. You talked about it was being multicultural. You kind of alluded to a gang culture there. You know, I grew up in suburban Reading, you know, a million miles away. I went to a comprehensive school, you know, working class background, but completely different. What was it? And, you know, the school I went to, I'm mixed race, half Pakistani, half Welsh. I was the only brown skinned boy in the class. What was it like? Because I know that Rio, later in life, you went to the school in which Stephen Lawrence went to, who was murdered, of course, famously. But just try and give us a flavour of what it was like growing up there, the challenges you faced.
The challenges, as I say, I've probably painted it to be worse than probably what it was. Yes, there was challenges in terms of gang members coming onto the estate, but in terms of our actual estate, it was all about football, to be honest with you. It was all about football for us. You know, and whoever had the ball was the cool kid, you know. And we just wanted to get on the pitch and play football on the back grass or on the pen or over the road to the Adventure Playground. and play football. But it was a case of, like, we never ever looked around and thought, oh, okay, well, that person's white, that person's black, that person's Indian, that person's Chinese, because everyone was there, we was just one, you know. And I think the biggest thing, the difference now on an estate to when I grew up and when Rio grew up, is there's a community in terms of, so if our estate was really, really big, so if we was on a part of an estate where our family, our mum and dad couldn't see us, and one of our friends' mum and dads lived over that way, and we was acting up, their parents could actually say, listen, Anton Rio, what are you doing? Sort yourself out. And that was accepted, you know. Or it would be a case of they'd ring through to mum, and they'll come back and say, mum said you better go get home now. So it was that type of community vibe on the actual estate. But it was very, very competitive on the estate. I remember watching Rio and his friends. They're all a lot older than me, and most of them are older than Rio as well. And the competitiveness, not just at football, but they used to do 100-metre sprints down a road called Friary Road. And it was a case of you can't lose. If you lost, then you was the joke for the rest of the night, and you'd get opened up for the rest of the night. And I suppose watching that and then taking that into my age group, it prepared me for football and for what a football change room is really like.
So, you know, it's interesting there, Anton and Rio. So, listen, we've all done exceptionally well in our field, whether it's Matthew in table tennis and writing and books and you two in football. What we went through to get to where we wanted to get to in terms of the community, taking the ball out, going on the local grass pitch, putting jumpers down. You know, our kids have all come from, probably because we've done well, we worked exceptionally hard to get what we get to, affluent backgrounds, where our kids, well, my kids in particular, can't get the ball and walk out to all their mates, you know, and go on that grass pitch. So how do you instill those, you know, that mentality, that belief into your children, Rio? Because I suppose, like me, they won't be able to get the ball and walk to all their mates, like 20 a side on the local grass pitch.
Yeah, that's a big difference. And I'm always talking to, like, Anton and my mates and that about, like, how do you instill the friendships? How do you instill that hardness, that ability to be able to handle yourself among groups of people when the adult isn't there? Like, for instance, like now, if my kids are going to be getting their mates over or going to their mates' house, it's organised through the parents. It's a play date almost, do you know what I mean? So it's very different, whereas we were just thrown out the front door and said, come back when dinner time is. And you've got to then make your way through the estate and find people, go and knock for them, talk to adults, communicate with people, ask for things, and then navigate your way through that day without a parent overlooking over your shoulder and managing that process. It's a big difference. So you understand how to talk to people, you understand how to be a bit robust in certain situations and just manage yourself, whereas it's now kids are taken everywhere, they're picked up, every single part of their life is really managed, where it's a big difference. So then to transfer that into football, for your children to go into a football club and be able to talk to people, to be able to, because these kids don't talk to anyone other than if they're playing on a headset on a computer game. Everything's via text, everything's via social media. So for a kid to go and then to prepare them to go into a football club, I think it's a big thing. And that's why we're lucky with the school that we send our kids to, that's very big on them. But also at home, if we're in a restaurant, I see so many kids, when a waiter comes over, if you're in a restaurant and the waiter will go to the child, right, what do you want, son or love, what do you want? And they'll look at their parents. Yeah. And my kids used to do that at the beginning. I'd say, what are you looking at me for? Answer the way. What do you want? Don't tell me. Tell him or her.
I've got to say, I think this is one of the most important issues for young people today. This helicopter parenting, the mollycoddling.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
And actually, it's schools as well, by the way, because they learn in very controlled environments. They absorb all of this knowledge and then they're tested on whether they can regurgitate that knowledge, you know, whether
it's a memory lesson, isn't it?
It's basically a memory test. Yeah. What we need in the world of the future is initiative, the ability to take sensible risks, to make mistakes and learn from them. Because if you think about the digital world that kids are going to arrive in, I work in print journalism. I write for the Sunday Times and the Times. You know, newspapers won't exist in a decade.
Mm.
just being good at one thing, there is no profession for life. You have to be adaptable. You have to look for opportunities. You have to have the creativity and curiosity. So everything you just said there, Rio, I think is what we need in our education system. Parents need to understand to give their kids the space to come up with new ideas, to order from the menu. It sounds like a trivial thing. It's a significant thing. Let's go back to what you said earlier about occasionally messing up. Tell me whether this resonates. You know, my daughter took the risk of taking a lead role in a school play. And when you're in front of a lot of people, there's a chance you might fluff your lines. She fluffed her lines. I spent most of the evening praising her for having had the courage to go up there. I said, every great actor or actress has fluffed their lines at one time or another. What would have really hurt me is if you were passionate about acting and you never got on the stage because you wanted to stay perfect. You can't have that. So, you mentioned, Rio, about this really interesting, about trying to get your kids to take the initiative, to decide what they want to eat, to express it to a waiter or to a waitress. When you're talking to your kids when they've messed up, do you go after them or do you say, you know what, I'm glad you gave it a go? How do you find that balance?
It's a mixture of things. Sometimes I might go at them. Like if you're relating it to football and one of my kids make a mistake, like when if I'm outside messing about with them and we're doing something, I'm like, what are you doing? And I'll be on them like, sort your feet out, do it properly. Or they're not doing it with the intensity that I feel they should be doing it with. And I'll go, well, okay, I'm going to go in then. I'll leave you to it. See you later. And then I'm not thinking about that moment there. I'm thinking about tomorrow. What's the question going to be? Are they going to ask me to go outside again because they want to keep doing it? And they're going to show me that they're doing it differently and that the intensities that I was asking for is there, or the quality with which they're working is there? Or are they going to go, you know what, I'll just stay and play computer? I gauge what they're like through things like that. I think going at my kids constantly, listen, I'm probably getting it wrong some of the time, but I try not to. You have to stop yourself because you want them to do so well, but to keep peppering them all the time with like criticism and being negative, I don't think works. Sometimes I go, okay, see you later, and I'll walk in. I won't say what the problem is, and then maybe later I'll say to them, well, why do you reckon I walked in earlier? And then I want you to tell. Then they tell me, and I go, okay. So next time you want me to stay out, you act right.
I'm loving this conversation because you're so strategic as a dad. My wife says I'm a bit overly strategic, but I think like that. Robbie, do you relate to all this as a dad?
Yeah, 100%. You know, where I, on a previous podcast, Anton and Rhea, which we've done with Andrew Flintoff, we talked about, there was an episode about youngsters, and Matthew at one point, and we disagreed, myself and Freddie, that his son would pay 20 pence or 30 pence if he done something right. If he achieved something, he would pay him, which I totally disagree with. Anton, I know your son is a development squad. He's only six, isn't he? You know, there was no way in the world.
Seven.
There was, you know, I disagreed with that. An incentive to do well. Surely it was wrong, wasn't it?
Yeah, for me, that's wrong. Paying, putting money in a kid's pocket because they've done something well. For me, is wrong. I think, especially at my son's age, praise should be enough. I think I always wanted praise from Rio or my dad. That was enough for me, you know. And moving on to later life, it was a case of my family told me I was a good enough footballer. Forget about Rio, I was a good enough footballer. So whatever they said to me, whatever was said within our four walls of our flat in Peckham, that's what mattered. Anything that people had to say outside of it, we don't really care about it, you know? And that weren't done on, okay, well, you do this and that's great, we're gonna give you something. It was, okay, that's great, you've done well for yourself. You know, that was always, you've done well for yourself. I didn't do well for Rio, I didn't do well for my mum, I didn't do well for my dad, I've done well for myself. And let's say my son's seven and West Ham have been after him for a very, very long time, and I've always said no to West Ham until about 3 months before the lockdown started. And they always used to ask me, why are you saying no to us? And I said, because the pressure that my son will be under there, you walk into Chadwell Heath, there's pictures of Rio, there's pictures of me, you know. But my wife said to me, listen, he's always going to have this, so you have to let him get used to it now from this young age. And I was like, okay, yeah, that's fair enough. So when I spoke to West Ham, they have two different squads. They have an indoor squad, which is the academy, and they have the development squad, which is outside. And they wanted to put him directly in with the academy squad. And I said to them, no, that's not the way to do it. I said, if he's going to come, he has to go outside with the development squad. And they was like, yeah, but he's good enough to go inside. I said, whether he's good enough or not, that's you, let him make your decision for you. He needs to go outside and prove to himself and prove to you that he's good enough to be inside. And they was like, yeah, but we know he's good enough. I said, no, I want him to go outside so he understands he's not here because dad played for West Ham. He's here because he's a good player. And he's here in his own right. And not just that, I grew up hearing, you will never be as good as Rio. I grew up hearing this stuff. And I know he's going to get that at some point. But for me as a parent, I don't want to go and sit upstairs and watch my son training and hear a parent go, he's only here because of his dad. If I know that he's worked his way in from outside and he's proved to himself that he's good enough to get inside and proved to the coach he's good enough to get inside, people saying that ain't going to affect me.
Anton, do you know what? Anton, do you know what? I can honestly relate to that, as I've spoken to Rio about this, that I've been at Manchester United. My boy's been there since the age of 5. He's a second-year scholar now, and I've heard it. He's only here because of his dad. And that, for me, it really, really hurt. And it hurt Charlie, because I'm like you, and I know one of Rio's boys is at a club and the other one isn't. I wanted him to be successful on his own, and I used to stay out of it. I used to let my wife give her number, or my wife take him. And I was holding myself back, because if I turned up for games, all of a sudden, you know, because I was recognisable, that's Robbie Savage, which one's his boy? And the pressure would automatically come on him. And I thought as a parent, I'm putting even more pressure by going to watch my son. So I wouldn't go and watch him as often as I could and stand back, because the pressure would automatically, listen, and the Ferdinand name is huge. So for Anton, I relate to what you say. And real for you, when you go and watch one of your boys in an academy, that must be so hard that when you turn up, listen, you're a global superstar. People say, there's Rio Ferdinand. Same with you, Anton. That's added pressure for our children.
It is. And I don't know, I've been lucky so far that my boys, at the moment, doesn't seem like it affects them. They don't hear the noise. I've always tried to say to them, whatever anyone says to you, you'll determine if you're good enough or not. And I've said to them since they were young, you ain't going to a football club because I say so. You're going to a football club if you get asked. And I'll tell you, if a scout asks me, I will tell you. And so any idea that I'm going to get you in, or you're going to get a cheap shot into a club, ain't happening. You earn the right only. And so, and I've been, I think, I don't know if I'm lucky or just because of the way we've brought them up, is that at the moment, they don't feel that pressure of being, because they're my kid. And that's refreshing. And it's good to see, but they're getting to an age now where there might be kids in their age group that say stuff to them, and then it's how they react, because they haven't had that yet. So,
would you say though, Ree? Would you say that perhaps you might not feel that because you haven't been in that position where there is pressure in terms of you're following someone's footsteps? Yeah, you had Les, but it's a second cousin.
Yeah.
Whereas like me, I know the exact feeling. So I'm probably a bit more protective than you, because I know the feeling. I've had it. I've listened to it, you know. So, but as I say, my son hasn't. He don't understand. He don't feel the pressure yet. He's too young, you know. He doesn't. But one thing that was apparent to me very, very young, to watching him, and like going anywhere with him, like for instance, going to a Turkish restaurant to pick up a takeaway, and I'll take him with me, and he'll have his football kit on. And the first thing that they'll say to him, are you going to be better than your daddy and your uncle? You know, that's the first thing they'll say to him. Are you going to be better than your daddy and your uncle?
Yeah.
You know, that's pressure in itself. But
so Anton, you know what you're saying there, that you had the pressure of Rio. How did that make you feel when you would used to hear, like, because sibling rivalry, I know the 7 years between you, so it wasn't that great, because... But how did that make you feel? Because, you know, my brother's 4 years older than me, and I've never sat him down and asked him, do you know what, being the younger sibling, and he's done great in his own life, he's done great in his field, but, you know, I was the one who would be in the papers. I was the one everybody talked about. And, you know, you've both had amazing careers, but when everybody used to hear people say, well, you're not going to be like Reed, you're not this, how did that make you feel?
I would just let it bounce off of me. As I said, I would always revert back to my to being in the flat in Peckham, and being told whatever gets said within these four walls, that's all that matters. I just reverted back to that, you know. And not just that, here in Rio, like, as much as our competitive he is and stuff, and probably deep down, he would never have wanted me to be better than him because he's that competitive, but he wanted me to make it as a footballer. I think he always showed me that support. So I didn't really, I don't know, the way I was brought up and the environment I was brought up in, it hardened my skin to be able to deal with that type of stuff and let it just bounce off of me, if I'm honest.
John, I think one of you said, I think it was you, Rio, about my youngest, Freddie, he plays in my team, and he's quite petite, and he hasn't hit that growth spurt yet. And we played in the semi-final, and I had a few scouts afterwards saying, do you know what, would he come in? And I said, he's not ready. You know, maybe, am I being selfish? I'm not sure I am, because at 14, you know, technically he's good, but he is quite small. And I don't want him to go into a club and get disappointed, told he's not good enough, he's got a difficult time enough at school, the pressure on school. Am I being selfish? I know you've got two, one's in academy, one's not. You know, am I being selfish not to allow my boy to go into academy? Maybe I'm doing it, Ree, because financially, you know, I had a decent career. Maybe if I was, you know, in a different situation, maybe I would push my boy into an academy.
I don't know. I don't mind seeing them fail. I've got to be honest with you. I just think it's part of life. They've just got to deal with it. And I think if you can be there to support them and just to reinforce that, listen, guy, if you're going to go in, you might not get a contract, but just put your best foot forward. And if it don't work out, we'll just go back to what you was doing before. And then in a year or two's time, you can come back.
Yeah.
It's like what you were talking about before, Matthew, about always saying well done and reinforcing, wow, you've done really well all the time in any given situation. I don't agree with that. I only because my experience, like, my dad was very hard. And my dad was very, very, like, he didn't show any...
Honest.
He was honest, but to a point where I'd get in the car, if I'd scored a hat-trick, I could have scored 7-8 goals in a game, and I'd be sitting there waiting on the journey home for him to say, well done. And I'd be sitting thinking, and I'd be thinking, like, what, like, any chance you're just saying, like, oh, what a goal that was today or something. And so I'd sit there after 10, 15 minutes, and I'd go, I've done all right today, Dad, didn't I? And he'd go, yeah, you've done all right.
It's so interesting, because you meet, I mean, I've interviewed a lot of world-class sports people, and I've got to tell you, a lot of them had dads who were incredibly tough. Mm. I mean, David Beckham's father, Ted, I went and spent a couple of hours talking to him, and he would say David would have scored 3 free kicks, and I wouldn't give him that praise. I'd make him work harder for the praise, because I thought that was one of the ways I could motivate him to get better. Coming back to something you said earlier, by the way, about how to get the balance with kids who are passionate about something and then pushing them to fulfill their promise in that passion, I think that's really powerful. I think the problem is, if kids are doing something not because they're truly passionate about it, but because they're doing it to please a parent or coach,
the worst
that's
thing.
Too big a contradiction, right? These are the kind of kids who are going to burn out. I think if you allow, as you said, Ria, you know, the young person to make a commitment to a sport or an activity they really care about, and then you encourage them that way, you're going with the grain of their motivation. Mm. And I think that's one of the things that's quite difficult as a parent, is to give kids that space to try and figure out where they want to go, and then do all the things that you mentioned.
But the kids there that you're talking about, who are doing it for their parents or being really pushed by the parents, they're the kids that when they come up and they get a challenge in their life and or it doesn't go the way they want it, they're the ones that normally down tools and give up early.
Exactly.
And say, you know what, I can't do this, I'm tired of this now, I'm 16 years old, I've been doing this for 6 years, after time I've not really wanted to go, if they say to themselves, but they wake up an excuse probably and walk away from it. And it's a lot of the time, I think, it's down to that pushy parent or the kid just really trying to please that parent. And it's not really their passion.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And there's a lot of scientific evidence that backs up that analysis, because they do these big data sets to work out why some people persevere, why they continue to commit. And it's a lot to do with the internal passion.
Just talking about that, you're talking about data. What, you've done a book, didn't you, called Bounce?
And that talks about my first book in 2010, yeah.
That talks about the 10,000 hours. Can you just explain that a little bit? Because, like, I've not read it yet, unfortunately, but I understand the idea behind I've heard so much about it in that respect.
Yeah, thanks, Rio. So basically the idea is, we tend to obsess about talent. And we tend to exclude all of these other things that are important if you want to be the best that you can be. Because you also need great coaching. You need great parenting. You need mentoring. You need the motivation. Most importantly, you need to clock up practice. Because if you walked onto a football pitch, no matter what your genetic makeup, and you haven't gone through those hours of playing in the adventure playground, sprinting down the street, manipulating the ball, doing keep-me-ups, playing matches, you're never going to be able to fulfill that talent. So what I was trying to do in Bounce is to say, yep, talent's a factor. But unless we take a step back and look at all of these other dimensions that are important for people to reach the top, we're not going to be able to help people to get to where they can get to. So that's basically the argument. In fact, almost everything we've been talking about today fits into the stuff that I was talking about in Bounce. And actually, the second book, it might be a good moment to transition into another thing, because I mentioned a bit earlier about my racial background. You know, I grew up as the only kid with brown skin in my school. When I left school, there was a bakery. And on the back door, it had this racist slogan with the P word, kick peas out of this country. And I walked past it every single day for about 6 years. And every time I walked by, I was hoping I wasn't with a friend or, you know, a girl that I might fancy, because it made me feel excluded. We've had a massive cultural moment in this country and around the world over the last couple of months with Black Lives Matter. I think it's a real opportunity to reset who we think we are and how we define ourselves as a nation. I would love to hear your perspective on this, what it was like growing up from your background. You're both mixed race, as I understand, I think. Just tell us what it was like. Yeah, perhaps Anton, if you could start. I'd love to know what you make of it, about where we are now.
Where we are now, I think it's the first time where we can sense there's going to be change, you know, I think. But the biggest thing for me is that in the difference in now to back when we was younger or back before our time, is that everyone's talking about racism the way it should be spoken about, you know. And leaders and the people that are in the powers that be, they're seeing people that look like themselves when they look in the mirror talking about racism in a negative way. You know, so looking at it and going, you know what? Someone that I look like is talking about this. There must be a problem. You know, I think that's what's creating that sense, that air of change within the world and within our country. But growing up, we never ever saw colour. You know, we never saw it.
Football was an inclusive community for you?
Yeah, but it wasn't just the football. Our environment on our estate, anything we'd done, there's that Turkish boy, there's Osman, who was my best friend growing up, you know, or there's that black boy or that African boy, or it was just, there's so-and-so, you know, there was never any colour that even entered our head, you know.
But this is so, Anton, sorry to interrupt, that is so interesting, because one of the things that people are saying today is that if you are from an ethnic minority, you're always conscious of who you are, of your identity, of the colour of your skin, about being excluded. But you didn't feel that growing up. You felt that this community in Peckham, on the estate, they valued you for who you were, your character, not your colour.
Yeah. And then when I started to understand that colour played a part was when I started to venture off the estate and go to different areas. That's when I started to realise that colour. Don't get me wrong, I was brought up to know I was a black man. That's how we were brought up. We are black men. You know, my mum was white, our dad is black, but we was always told from our mother, who was white, society sees you as a black man, so you are black, you know. And listen, I didn't quite understand that until I did come off the estate and started to hear certain things
For example, Anton, you know, you leave the estate. Was it the N-word? Was it people excluding you? What did it feel like for you?
I'll give you an example. I went to, when the new den first opened, Millwall's ground, when they first opened, and it was their first game, they played against Liverpool, and a lot of our friends were Liverpool supporters. But one of my friends, his name's Scott, he's a Millwall fan, and we went to the game, and we went to go and watch John Barnes, who we all loved, on the estate. And we were sitting in one of the stands at the new den, and John Barnes done something. I think he got fouled and they thought he dived and everyone was shouting. I know at Millwall, unless you stood up and got involved, they'll look at you and go, what are you for the other team? What are you doing here? And they would cause trouble. So, you know, like you stand up and you shout, referee or whatever. And all of a sudden, I heard, John Barnes, you black so-and-so. And I looked and I turned to him and I was like, what? And he went, no, not you, mate. You're right. You're one of us. And I heard that and I was like, I started to process it. And I was like, listen. And I heard after that, I had to leave. I just got up. I said to the boy, I said, listen, I can't stay. I've got to go. And I left. And that was one of my first real encounters of racism in terms of going to a football match. And I said, I left because it was like, I'm the same as him. I'm black. But I'm okay because I'm with you. I couldn't quite fathom it. I couldn't understand it. You know, that how comes I'm accepted when I'm like him? How can I be accepted when I'm like him? Just because I support the same team as you. I couldn't fathom it. I couldn't like understand it at all.
Thank you, Anton. Rio, what was it like for you? What are your thoughts? You know, firstly, about growing up as a black man in Peckham, when you left the estate, when you started developing as a footballer, and what was it like to integrate into the elite football community? What were the challenges and barriers?
No, I think a lot of what Anton said is very similar. In terms of growing up, our estate was very multicultural, so I didn't feel racism in that sense. There were odd incidents where you might feed it from certain people being called names sometimes here and there, but my general circle of people, it wasn't something that happened. But again, like Anton, I left football. I went on the football pitch sometimes. There'd be moments where people would call you names, and I got into tussles with people at times. So I always knew that, yeah, being the colour I was an issue for some people. And certain areas, we couldn't go to over a certain main road. You couldn't go from our side to that side past a certain time of night. No chance. You'd be looked at as a lunatic. What are you doing? You're going to go and get yourself into trouble because of the colour of your skin. So it was always made to be aware. But looking at going from my childhood and then becoming a football player, I think you very much get taken out of reality. And colour,
yeah,
as people may see and speak about you as colour, but to your face, you're treated like a superstar. You're treated like a godlike figure. So colour quickly becomes taken out of that situation. And so you live a bit of a more privileged life in that sense. So for instance, going to a restaurant, I don't get looked at the same way that I'd be one of my friends who's just got a career as a solicitor or whatever he's doing would walk into that restaurant. He'd be looked at as if to say, and I can see that and I sense that as, oh, well, how's he in here? Like, and obviously I'm seeing things like that from afar, but when it's me, it's not directed at me like that because, oh, it's Rio, he's fine. So football enables you to kind of sidestep a lot of those issues in your normal walk of life. But at the same time, if you're in a place or a country where you're not recognised, it really quickly comes back to that again and you feel that sense of, oh, actually, I'm seen as a colour rather than as a person now. And right. So it can take you back to that quickly. But I just think this movement that's happened in recent months, this BLM movement and race being a real hot topic and centre of attention in the media, I think it's a great opportunity now to see some sort of change. I don't think all the slogans have worked in the past. I think all of that is hot air and it's here today, gone tomorrow.
You know, taking it, listen to the three of you speak about racism, you're taking it back to me as a youngster in Wrexham. You know, in our school, you know, all white boys and girls. And the first black person come to our school was called Jim Whitley. You know, Rio and Anton, you'll remember the Whitley brothers. Mm. And Jim, and it was my first experience of racism, you know, towards Jim, that, you know, he'd come into the classroom, you know, and the words, the names called behind his back was disgraceful. And I didn't see the colour of Jim's skin. I didn't see him as a black person or a white person. I seen him as Jim. And the power of sport, he was so talented. He was a great footballer, went on to play for Man City, a scratch golfer, great singer, great artist. All my paintings in my house are from Jim. You know, and I wanted to get to know Jim for the person he was. You know, people wouldn't sit next to him in class. You know, and I look back now, Ray and Anton, and, you know, it hurts me to think that all these years, and I wrote about it in a newspaper article, that Jim used to go home and cry, the things said about him, and I never really asked him, was he okay? How was he? You know, but what I did, I befriended him because he was Jim, not because he was black, not because he was white, because I seen the person, and what he went on to achieve was quite incredible, quite remarkable, you know, whether he's black or he was white. But I seen the person, and nobody else in our class did, and it was the horrible stuff behind his back, and it really hurt Jim, and I didn't really understand until recently that what Jim would have gone through, and I wish I'd have been there more for him in terms of, you know, my mother and father were great with him. He was my best pal, Ree, and still is. I still speak to him a lot. But it was just horrible to witness it at such a young age of the racism that I'm sure you three have experienced. You know, and for me to sit in this chair as a middle-aged white person, I've never experienced what you three and what Jim went through. So for me to, I know what's right and wrong. So I can say, yeah, it's wrong. You know, racism, it's wrong. It's horrible. But for me, it's very difficult to understand what Jim went through. I know now because I've spoke to him, and what you three went through.
Andrew, I was just going to, just very quick question to you, because I was horrified, like you were, Rob, seeing what I felt was a clear instance of racial abuse that you received on a Premier League football pitch. Rio said a bit earlier that it became a bit more sanitised at the top level. I've often wondered the extent to which that John Terry incident was representative of the kind of abuse that happened that we didn't see, or whether that was a one-off. I just don't know.
No, it's not a one-off. That's not a one-off. There is, listen, on a football pitch, things get said. From the stands, you hear a lot. It's not a one-off. In football, there is a lot of racism. There's no getting away from that. You know, it's starting to rear its ugly head again. Over the last 18 months, you're starting to see and hear of more and more things happening. And it's definitely not a one-off thing. But the important thing is how it's dealt with and how things are dealt with to move forward, to let people understand and educate people, whether they're the victim, whether they're the perpetrator, educating them and supporting them in the right way, where they can move forward in their life and know what's right and wrong. I think, like Robbie said there, talking about his mate Jeff, I have to say, Robbie, that's a credit to your parents, the fact that you didn't see colour. You know, your upbringing showed you that you don't see colour, and that's a credit to your parents, especially in the era that they grew up in. You know, the era that they grew up in, colour was a massive, massive thing.
Jim was part of the family, Anton. Jim was part of the family, Jim and Jeff. They become part of the family. That, you know, Jim, you know, come from Zambia and, you know, lived in a tough area in Wrexham, very, very tough area, you know, limited modes of transport. My father would pick him up. We'd go out of our way to go and get him, which we'd done, right, because we felt, he was my friend. He was my friend. And I wasn't his friend because I felt sorry for him or because people were picking him. He was my friend because he had great morals, he had great work ethic, he was just a great kid. And, you know, a lot of people might have stayed away. I don't know what it had been like. Like, a lot of people might have stayed away from Jim because he was black, but I couldn't see that. And it was abhorrent to think back now that what Jim went through, and for me not to ask him, are you okay, mate? I look back now and think, do you know what, I wish I had done more for him.
To be fair, Sav, I understand that you didn't ask him because you wouldn't know. It's like, for instance, if I said to you now, have you ever walked down the road and saw an older lady or a couple of people and thought, I bet I'm going to cross the road because I can see that she feels a bit intimidated that I'm walking next to her or up to her because of the colour of my skin, and you know that's the issue. Or you walk up to a shop window, look in the window, go to walk in, and the security guard says, no, you can't come in. You're not allowed because of the colour of your skin. Do you know what I mean? Or the fact that you're going to go you're going into a job application, and you're thinking, putting my real name down there is going to be an issue. I think I might have to lie about what my surname is, or going in and thinking, am I going to be judged because of the colour of my skin? I've got probably 50% chance of not getting this job. They're the type of things that a lot of people who aren't from different backgrounds, from ethnic backgrounds, they would never have to consider those things. And so when people say, oh, it ain't that bad, when you just start mentioning a couple of things like that, and then people go, oh, actually, well, I don't have to do that. I have never had to go through that. Or saying to your kids at some point, if a policeman comes over to you and starts stopping you, you've got to act a certain way because you don't know what's going on in the current climate of things. You don't know how the policeman's going to react in the current climate. So you react. What white parents are having them conversations with their kids and saying, I'm actually fearful for my son because of a few things that I'm seeing on social media, in the media now. So you've got to have them certain conversations with your young kids coming into teenage years about the colour of their skin.
So you three educate your children, you educate them.
I think you have to, because obviously our kids now, they're on social media, they're seeing all these things. Dad, what's going on here? The policeman have just killed that other black lady or that black guy. You've got to explain that. And that conversation then goes back to historical and given experiences that we've been through. So the kids are very much aware as to, oh, wow, that does go on. So they're not walking out naive. And in
the beauty of your story, though, Robbie, I would say is now, so your parents educated you not to see colour, which you've now passed on to your children, right?
Yep.
But you're sitting there now regretting that you never checked on Jeff and his brother to see how they were doing and how they felt. You can now install that into your children, you know? So that education moves on. But it filters down, but you're moving it on to something else.
I mean, this, I think, has been a genuine, fascinating conversation on race and racism and bigotry. Rio, did you want to... I've got some final questions, by the way, but Rio, you're about to say something.
The only thing I was going to add to what I was saying before is that the only way to help the process of eradicating it is education. I think that the school curriculum should have some stuff that is relative to these kids' recent. And so that there is an interest there, genuine interest that they can touch and feel and see and go, wow, that wasn't too long ago. And have the history as well. But there's to be something that incentivizes these kids to want to learn. And so these kids can't be then dictated to by parents or the ignorant parent at home or the ignorant family member or friend who says, oh, this is what it is and it's racist. And the kid, because if you're not educated, you can't fight back or have that conversation or that debate in your own household. Until you're educated and you understand the situation as to actually why are people racist, why are black people upset with their oppression, etc. This is why, actually, Dad. And then that kid's educating his dad in the end, and the dad can't actually be the person to influence that kid because he knows he's got the tools to fight back and answer back.
Adding to your point there, Ria, about something, them having something relatable, which is something that is closer to this day and age, is the reason, one of the reasons why I've done this racism documentary. I think is for people in sports to understand and people in football to understand, not just football but in life, to understand what is right and what is wrong. And not just that, is for the powers of football and the powers that be in corporate world to understand that they've got a role to play in terms of supporting both parties, not just the victim but supporting the perpetrator too, because one, that perpetrator, he needs educating. He needs to understand that the environment that he was brought up in, ain't the right environment nowadays. So they can educate their children. I think that's one of the reasons why I've done this documentary, is to make sure that people understand and know that there's always two sides to a story, but both sides matter.
Yeah.
You know, I think in my situation, only one side of the story mattered. And that was because he was bigger than me in terms of, as a footballer, in terms of stature. My story didn't matter. You look at Raheem Sterling speaking up, and I think it's fantastic that he spoke up when he got racially abused by the Chelsea fan. But say, for instance, it was a fellow England player that racially abused him, and a big one at that. Would it have had the same outcome? You know, would it have been allowed to be spoken about the way his situation was spoken about? Because if going by mine, it wouldn't have been. You know, I think it is important to me that people understand and know that. And it couldn't have come at a better time with BLM and stuff going on at the moment. I just think it's imperative that people understand that, and people within football, it can't just be black people talking about racism. Everyone has to talk about it. And we're starting to get that now, which is why there's a movement within football, not just in society, but in football. You know, BLM's doing good things. There's white people, black people supporting this case and this cause. So we have to adhere to that in football. And when it was my time, it was only black people talking about it. Where was the white people? I had meetings where my mum was the only white person in the room. You know, I always thought, what is this? We're talking about racism. Racism's multicultural. So why everyone should have a say on this? You know, I use Kick It Out as an example. Kick It Out, they, when it comes to their the stuff that they do, their campaigns, they ask every ethnicity to wear their shirts, kick racism out of football. But when something happened, there's only black people in the meeting. That don't make sense.
Yeah,
hold on.
That's so true, Anton. And I'm looking forward to watching that documentary. But can I just say thank you, Anton and Rio. It's been genuinely fascinating. The one thing I regret is I had about 30 questions about parenting to Rio. All the different dilemmas I've got. I'm thinking, what would Rio do in this situation? I want to see if you're thinking in the same way. But let's do that another time. Finish with three quick fire questions, if I may. Robbie, we're going to finish with these each week. So you can maybe join in this time if you want. In your profession,
it's been fascinating, Matthew. Absolutely,
it's been great, hasn't it?
Fascinating, and yeah, the racism topic. You know what you three have experienced, but also that if Anton and Rio can not put their son or daughter in an academy because they don't feel they're ready, that's a big thing for me, and that is a huge, huge thing in modern day society. The willingness for parents to put their son or daughter into an academy because they can see the financial goals when they're not ready. And then the lasting effects of them, the disappointment by being released, is mentally scarring on youngsters. So I think I've taken from this podcast that, you know, if Anton and Rio can do that with the history and the pedigree they've got as footballers, they think, you know what, my son's or daughter's not ready. We'll put them in, or they've got to do it on their own. That for me is fascinating. That for me is what I've done with my youngest son.
Okay.
I think what we can't and we haven't touched on is, I think there's a thin line in it. But as a parent, making sure your kids understand this is hard work. It's not easy. It's hard work. I think that's the biggest thing. I don't think you can say that enough. Like, yeah, praise them and stuff. But I think when you're educating your kids in what they want to do, anything they want to do in life is going to be hard work. It's not going to come easy, you know. So like with my son, I always say to him, football is not easy, football is hard, you know, but the harder you work, the more you will enjoy it.
And I think the to finish on that, the coronavirus has been testing for everybody, this situation, and what we've taken out of it as a family, is from my two boys especially, is what are you doing now when everybody's playing computer games and everybody's resting? What is your incentive now to go out and work? And that's what I said to him at the beginning of the when the virus kicked in, after a couple of weeks and we're sitting there working out what you should be doing, how long we're going to be in this situation. And I was sitting there just thinking, right, I'm not going to keep asking you to go out and train. You've got to go and do it yourself. Dad, can you take me on a run? Dad, can you do some drills with me? Can you come to the park and play football? Blah, blah. And so it was just very much like that. And it's been interesting because one of my sons went back to his academy the other day and he had to do some tests and some running. And he came back and I could see he was proud of himself that he'd done well for one. But the more important thing, he acknowledged that, Dad, if I didn't work hard in that period of the virus, I'd have been behind everyone. And I felt comfortable in the top tier of the physical activities we were doing because of what we'd done at home. And that was a massive lesson. One of them's learnt it, and I'm hoping the other one has as well. But there's other things that have got to happen for him to realise if he has or not. But at least one of them's got it.
Rio, that's fascinating because in most families, you'll have one sibling that is more talented than the other. Do you, as a parent, do you then give more love and time to the one who's less talented, possibly? It's a very difficult balancing act for parents in that situation, I think. And I don't mean give more love, but do you spend more
attention,
time possibly
yeah.
with a, attention as the one who's maybe not as good at school, who's not as quick, who's not as good on the piano, who's not as good at football. Do you give more attention to the younger sibling, or it's a difficult balancing act, isn't it?
I do both, really, but I end up steering towards the one who doesn't apply himself as well. Forget talent. The one that doesn't apply himself as well and doesn't give me the intensity that I think they should, I end up leaning towards them to try and get it out of them. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Because I can leave the other one because I know he's going to do it right. I've not got to watch him do the 10th or the 11th, 12th run or drill or rep. The other one, I've got to be on him.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Okay, here we go. In your profession, what was your weakest part of your skills and the thing you had to work the hardest to improve? Anton?
My concentration.
Rio?
Mine was the same, concentration.
Roberto?
The weakest thing?
Passing.
Was my... my physicality. I was 9 stone.
Too small. What is the one thing that you've got no talent in whatsoever but wish you had? Anton?
I was going to say DIY, but over lockdown I've realised I have. Probably doing the washing at home. Clothes washing, probably. No talent in that.
Rio?
Singing.
Really?
Yeah.
Weren't you in Bugsy Malone?
Yeah, that was when I was about, before my voice broke, when I was about 12. But
right.
If I could have been a singer, that was my next calling.
Got it.
Musical instrument. I'd love to have played the guitar, the piano.
Yeah. Last one. This is quite a deep question. What is the best single piece of advice that anybody has given you? Anton?
Play the game, not the occasion.
Love it. Who said that?
Rio.
Rio, what's yours?
Yeah.
Just to outwork everyone in the room.
Love it. By the way, was Ferguson a good coach? Overrated or underrated?
He was a great manager. And I think he was somebody that... he'd never treated everyone with a blanket treatment. It was always very individual and he would go, right, I'll treat him differently to I'll treat him. And he had that kind of personal touch. Like, my granddad was ill once. He sent flowers. He knew my granddad would come to a game. He'd be in the bar. I'd met him once or twice. But there's a brandy waiting for my granddad. Well, my mum was ill in hospital. There was a bunch of flowers at the hospital. Like, so, and then all of a sudden you're sitting there thinking, wow, this guy, like... But he was a very... and he led by example. He was in early, stayed late. And if he's been there 25 years winning trophies and you come in after 1 or 2 years and you think you're going to come in late and leave early, you're going to leave quickly.
Fascinating. Thank you, Rio. Robbie, best piece of advice you've ever had?
So when I was 15, when I was signed for Manchester United and was leaving, my mother said to me, no matter what you do in life, it's nice to be important, but it's more important to be nice.
Nice.
And I think when successful people... You know, they change and, you know, they become not nice people. You know, the other things matter more. But I think it's nice to be important, but far more important to be nice.
That was
my
from,
mum's, that's just,
that's from Val, who grew up in Wrexham, like my mum.
Yeah.
Good upbringing there. Guys, thank you so much. It's been brilliant.
Cheers, guys.
Ferdinand. Rio Ferdinand. Cheers. Robbie Savage. That's the end of our first ever episode of Talent Takes Practice. We're going to be back next week with some more guests. But for now, from all of us, thank you very much for listening.
Cheers, guys.
That was great.
Wow,
thank
that was
you.
Brilliant, guy. Wow, super. That was fascinating.
The Nevilles are going to have to go some to beat that.